Welcome to the Politocrat. I'm Omar Moore. It is Wednesday, June the 9th, 2021. On this edition of the Politocrat, if we are making it clear to some immigrants that they cannot come here to the United States, and if we are spending billions of dollars on defense, why aren't we spending anything or investing anything in keeping the United States Capitol and other government buildings safe from attack? My focus today is the report from the Senate, the bipartisan report on security measures in the wake of the January 6th, 2021 terrorist attack on the U.S. Capitol building and on the country itself. That coming up next. Welcome back. So I do want to get to this question of why are we doing what we're doing, but not securing the very buildings and the very places in government that are critical to the inner workings of the federal government? Why are we not doing that? I mean, I do want to take a deeper dive into this, and I will be playing some audio for you on this edition. I hope you're well on this Wednesday. I want to play you, and I will be playing you, a couple of pieces of audio that should kind of make your hair stand up on the back of your neck or make you itch your scalp. I don't know what it might be, but I listened to this, and I had to listen to it twice, actually. Both of these pieces of audio, particularly the first piece of audio. And it surrounds the release yesterday of the bipartisan report in the Senate on security around January the 6th, 2021, and what was done, what wasn't done, those kinds of things. The U.S. Capitol building, the U.S. Capitol police, the FBI, and all of these kinds of things. I want to get into that report, and you'll be hearing some audio about that report. It was 100-plus-whatever-page report. I think it was a 125-page report that was released yesterday. And it just talks about security. It doesn't say anything about anybody else or anything else. Then you think about this as you listen to this audio that I'm going to play to you. Think about the fact that just last week, the Republicans in the Senate voted no to debating whether there should be a January 6, 2021 commission so that the terrorist attack of that date could be investigated and looked into. The Republicans said, no, we're not going to even vote for this, to debate it. Not for the commission, but just to debate. And that's the thing that you should be thinking about here also as you listen to this audio. In fact, I'm going to just get straight into it right now. Here is a portion of the PBS NewsHour with Judy Woodruff, and you will hear this audio coming up right now.
Welcome to the NewsHour. The first congressional report detailing what went wrong on January 6th was released this morning. The 128-page bipartisan Senate document recounts significant intelligence and security failures leading up to and on the day of the attack, as well as a list of recommendations. We'll talk with one of the key senators behind the report, but first, Lisa Desjardins is here with me now to walk us through it. So, Lisa, this report is representing views from both political parties, we know. So give us the gist of what it says.
That's important. Let's get right to it. This focuses on the security failures of that day. First, one of the things that it found was that Capitol Police did have the intelligence. They had seen numerous postings online about potential violence, including bring a gun, for example, but that the police did not share that widely and did not make the correct assessment about how dangerous all of those pieces were. Also, something that I had not seen before, that the Pentagon, from interviews with the committee, the former defense secretary and former chairman of the chiefs of staff, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said the Pentagon actually wanted to lock down D.C. 2 days before January 6th because they were so concerned, and that idea was rejected. Now, the National Guard, we know the problems in the communications there. The request did not go through, and then when the request did go through to the Pentagon, it was delayed. All of that led to a finding in this report that the National Guard did not arrive at the U.S. Capitol until after the Capitol itself was secured. There is one of the 20 recommendations in this report that I think is most significant is that the Capitol Police be able to call upon the National Guard on their own. Right now, Capitol Police are overseen by what some believe is an antiquated board of three people who are appointed by Congress. They are slow to act. And it's notable that something that is not in this report. This report does not recommend any changes to that board structure. And I know Capitol Police believe that they can't do their job better until that structure changes. Something else not in this report is President Trump and any role he played on that day. That's because the whole purview of this report was limited to security failures on that day. That was the goal.
He is not mentioned. My name is Lisa. Have any of the concerns that are outlined in this report been addressed so far? And what is thought to be the state of readiness right now at the Capitol?
Well, the Capitol Police have responded to this report, and they say that there was not actually intelligence that an attack was coming. They say they are trying to change their staffing to kind of spread communications better in a way that will help them connect the dots better. But otherwise, Judy, there is a fence still around the Capitol building itself. But everything else systemically is about the same as it was on January 6th. And the National Guard has now left. In addition, you know, I have to say that the fencing and the future of security at the Capitol is unknown because lawmakers themselves have not decided how much they want to spend or how they want to do it. I think this report, what I'm saying is, lawmakers' own indecision is not just symbolic, but isn't a factor in the still kind of oversight of the Capitol and the security problems there. One other issue Capitol Police have right now, Judy, it's not well known, but I talked to many Capitol Police officers. I know some personally who have left since January 6th, and many officers tell me that they are not just short-staffed, but very short-staffed. Even if the Capitol could open for health reasons, they say they don't have the personnel to do it. They're concerned.
That is certainly a reason to be concerned. Lisa Desjardins, thank you for your reporting.
So what exactly is going on here? Madness is going on and sadness is going on and absolutely bizarre things are going on. You have a Congress that is very, very easygoing on what's going on. The report, as you just heard, did not mention the previous occupant of the White House. There were no real recommendations made. I mean, there were a few, and you will, if you read this report, you'll see some, but there weren't really any punishment measures at all in this report. It was only about security. If your house is burgled, you want to know what happened, other than the fact that it did happen. You want to know about why. You want to know about how. And you want, I think, some kind of explanation. So why on earth didn't this bipartisan committee in the Senate, Congress or whatever, either the Senate or in the, you know, the House, I mean, both part of Congress. Why wouldn't they and why didn't they get into this report more forensically regarding the security? I mean, obviously 125 or so pages would tend to lead you to a place that suggests a forensic exploration. I haven't read all 125 pages. I guess it would make for good summer reading, or maybe horrific summer reading. But what I do know is that a report that really doesn't punish anybody is a report that is fit to be thrown in the garbage, is a report that constitutes a waste of trees. And I just do not understand what the country is playing at here. I think it's pretty obvious what happened with the security and why it happened with the security and why, as you heard in that report, the Capitol Police why, as you heard in that report, the National Guard did not come until after the building had already been secured and the damage had been done. This was an inside job. Hello? In a word, this is the thing that just is so bizarre to me. And I know that in the United States here, we are in a society that does not value critical thinking. That generally speaking forsakes critical thinking. That generally speaking really doesn't embody any real critical thinking. You will find it in some educational institutions. You'll find it in law schools. And I engaged in critical thinking before I went to law school. I mean, I was engaging in this for a long time. And I dare say you were too. But it seems to me that you've got people who are supposedly well-educated, educated fools, bigoted fools, whatever the position you might take, who have been essentially taking a whiz on the security of the United States, taking a whiz on the safety and well-being of members of Congress, House and Senate, and giving us this literally piss-poor report, a waste of 125 pages. It's clear to me, at least, that this was an orchestrated terrorist attack. It was not a riot. Calling it an insurrection, though it may be, is too mild. It was more than an insurrection, as heinous as that is. It was a terrorist attack on the country. And one of the things I've said, and you know this, dear listener, because I've said it to you, I've bored you to tears about this over the last few episodes and beyond that, is that this was a terrorist attack. It was not a riot. It was not a riot. This was planned. This was prepared. We had all known not all of us, but many of us had heard for a number of weeks, at least three or four prior to the attack happening, that this was going to happen, that there was going to be this mass gathering on Capitol Hill in support of Donald Trump and so-called taking the country back. Not taking the country back, taking it back to the 1800s. That's what that was about, taking it back to the 1600s. And the messaging went across on Facebook and went across on other platforms of social media. This was known to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, your FBI. This gathering was known not only by the FBI, but it was known by many millions of users of Facebook. This was not a secret. It was an open sore. And nobody did anything to take any kind of preventative measures whatsoever. Especially when you knew of their violent rallies in 2015 and in 2016, when Donald Trump would have his rallies and his campaign, and there'd be people fighting, there'd be people, most of the time it wouldn't be fighting, it would be very one-sided. It would be white men punching and slapping black people, brown people. A black woman was roughed up and assaulted at a rally. He had a black man sucker punched in Minnesota by this old white man. And they apparently went out to tea and had crumpets a few days or weeks later, where the white man told the younger black man that he had sucker punched, like the coward that the sucker puncher was. Oh, I'm so sorry, young black man. I'm so sorry. Oh, I'm so sorry. I mean, this is the same guy that had said on television cameras, that I would have killed him. Pretty much said that after he had sucker punched him. The TV cameras found a celebrity. Hey, you've just sucker punched a black man. What would you like to say? Well, I he's lucky. I might have killed him. Guy didn't do anything. He didn't threaten this white man. This brother just walked up the steps, and all of a sudden, the sucker punch comes out of nowhere right to the face. And the police were standing there. I remember the video. And they didn't do anything. They didn't arrest this guy and jump on him and arrest him. They just stood there and watched. Just the same way the cops stood there and watched after Ryan, or I should say, Kyle Rittenhouse, said that he had shot and killed two people, blew the arm off another, had his AR-15, walked with his hands up, admitted that he shot and killed two people, and the police just watched him walk away. And earlier that night, in the August night of 2020 in Kenosha, Wisconsin, those same police in their tanks, like, you know, because Kenosha's like a war zone, you know. Kenosha's in Iraq, and so we've got to have tanks, and, you know, it ain't an American city. It's out in the Middle East somewhere. And they were giving Kyle Rittenhouse and his acolytes water. Thank you for being here. And the thing is, a lot of these police around the country, if you remember, in 2020, during the height of the protests in all over the world for George Floyd and for justice and for Black Lives Matter, a lot of these cops in the United States pissed off to not do their jobs. They pissed off home and didn't do their jobs. Oh, we're not going to show up. Remember that Buffalo police? Remember that white man that was pushed down? The old white man. Different old white man this time. This time, the cops brutalized him. Threw him down, his head smacked down on the sidewalk. You remember that video. Blood coming out of his ears. And then one of the cops tried to help him and he was swiftly admonished not to. And remember that whole thing? All of those white police officers, because that's who it was, white male police officers in Buffalo said, oh no, we're going to quit the unit that we're in and we're not going to show up for work. They're still police. No disciplinary action was held against them as far as I know. But we're not going to work. But we'll still take a paycheck and stay home. You know? I didn't hear Senator Lindsey Graham talking about, well, why are these people staying at home? They make more money by staying at home. Well, literally, these cops made more money staying at home. They were still getting paid their salaries. They weren't working. And all these cops all over the country, they were staying home. Same thing in Atlanta. Oh, well, we're going to just call out sick. Same thing in various other cities and states all over the country. We're going to just call out sick. We're not going to show up. And why? There's just no excuse for that. And that's the way I feel, quite frankly, about This report and the way so far that the United States Congress, House and Senate, have taken such kid gloves to a full-scale terrorist attack. And I think that that means that we have opened up this country for all kinds of things. Not like we haven't before. It's not new. It's just a different kind of new. And a scarier time and a scarier kind of new. That once again, in a very new realm, but something that's been going on for centuries, we absolutely love to make people feel very, very scared about the future, because, hey, we're not even going to protect our Capitol building, even though we knew that there could be some trouble. We knew about those violent, violent congregations at Donald Trump rallies. We knew that. Oh, but, you know, what could possibly go wrong here? Yeah, you know, he's an outgoing guy. He won't be back. He won't bother. So what's the point? I mean, we don't have to do anything. You know, he's not a black person. He's not a brown person. So we don't have to worry about security now, do we? Because he's white and, you know, he never put any act. He's not a violent person. He never attacked women. He never raped. You know, yeah, no. He had nothing to do with raping E. Jean Carroll. I guess it just happened by itself. You know, he's not a violent guy, this Donald Trump guy. He didn't put out ads in the newspaper in May of 1989 telling everyone who would read this sick racist ad to bring back the death penalty, bring back our police. No, he's not a violent guy, you see. He didn't say any of that. He didn't talk about people saying, you know, he didn't talk about people going around and knocking the hell out of people and knocking the crap out of them, will you? And I'll pay your legal fees. That wasn't him. I mean, we never saw this coming on January 6th. There was no warning that violence could happen. Of course not. Because, of course, someone that's saying that I'll pay your legal fees if you punch this guy in the face, he's just a pussycat. Why? He wouldn't even harm a fly. This is troublesome. This is troublesome. I don't think there's anything less. I mean, this is the bare minimum. Troublesome is the least of this. But it is. This is a banana republic. I want this place to be a better place, a better country. You can't be talking about making a country great when it isn't even better. Before you can make a country great, you've got to be better. All aiming for these superlatives without dealing with what's going on in the intermediary. You can't become great without getting better first. It's just pathetic. It's an empty-minded slogan that people like Ronald Reagan and others perhaps before him dug up. And so that gets thrown out there like it's some ingenious statement, which it isn't. But there is reason to be concerned. Look how easy it was for this guy to lie and allow for 400,000 people in the United States to die from coronavirus, COVID-19, last year. Look how easy it was. Telling the truth to an author and lying to the entire country at the same time. And for that, millions of people got sick and hundreds of thousands of people in the United States died. Yeah, you know, he's not a violent person. He doesn't like the sight of violence. He wasn't in a ring at a WWE event years ago, or a WWF event, I think it's WWE. He wasn't in that ring, body slamming people or clotheslining people. He didn't do that. Of course not. That's not a violent person. This isn't a person who was allowing for bounties on American soldiers. This wasn't that guy. No, of course not. No, he didn't do it. Why should we expect to think that there'd be some problems on January 6th? So much so that we didn't even bring any real resources to this. And the reason why there wasn't any is because, hello, who was in the White House during this whole thing? This guy still had 2 more weeks of his godforsaken term to run. So all of this would have been under his direction. And what has happened here is that you have people who are driving the getaway car for a criminal. Whether it was Brett Kavanaugh, whether it was God knows, you know, Amy Coney Barrett, both of whom are on the Supreme Court and shouldn't be. Neither of them should be, nor should Neil Gorsuch. That's three conservative judges who should not be there. But they are, thanks to Mitch McConnell. And quite frankly, thanks to the indifference of some voters here in the United States, who had they had fought harder in Kentucky and had the Democrats not run such a lousy candidate in Alison Lundigan Grimes, who wouldn't even admit publicly that she had voted for President Obama, we wouldn't have had this mess. We wouldn't have had 400 or so plus federal judges being put in by Mitch McConnell through Donald Trump. We wouldn't have had that. But again, this is why I keep talking about the importance of voting in every election that's out there, in your city, in your state, on the federal level. You have to stay engaged. This is a year-round endeavor. In a real sense, it is. Because you've got to be aware of the political landscape in your city, in your town, and certainly in your state. Those are the most important ones, those city, state, town. City, town, state. Very important. And the federal is also important, but it's the local stuff that gets overlooked and yet is the most important. And we have to get back to basics. We cannot take this for granted. And we cannot take this lightly, because these people are at it. They are going to try this again. They are going to try this again. I'm telling you, this terrorist attack that occurred just over 5 months ago now. I'm telling you, this is going to be attempted again. And next time, we may not be so fortunate. Here is what, and this is about 8 or 9 minutes long, here's what Senator Amy Klobuchar had to say about a variety of things, but she starts off talking about this really, I think, absolutely abominable report, where it seems as if nobody gave a rat's ass about what happened on January 6th, and obviously because it was Trump who was doing all this under his direction, who probably told them all to stand down. Listen to this for the next roughly 9 minutes or so from Senator Amy Klobuchar, the Democratic senator out of Minnesota.
She chairs the Rules Committee, which released today's report in a joint effort with the Homeland Security Committee. And she joins us now from Capitol Hill. Senator Klobuchar, welcome back.
Thanks, Judy.
Thank you for being here. So what would you say were the main failures outlined in this report?
Well, the first was really echoed in the words, the haunting words of one of the officers who said over the radio, "Does anybody have a plan?" There was just no preparation for this kind of an event, despite the fact that you had reports on social media of people posting pictures of the underground tunnels and the maps to the underground tunnels. So the number one thing, no preparation. No really plan for where the officers were stationed. This was not the fault in any way of the frontline officers. They valiantly defended and did their jobs. This was the leadership of the Capitol Police. You start with the fact that you have the officers, 75% of them were in their plain clothes. One of the platoons were not able to access their equipment because it was locked in a bus, so they could only look at it through the window. You've got situations where only 10% of them had civil disturbance training. And then you have three different intelligence units within the Capitol Police. And of course, that should be combined. On the outside, FBI, the reports that were coming in didn't get enough information to the high-level people in the Capitol Police. And as was noted, the Department of Defense, it took quite a while for them to get the National Guard over. So all in all, we made 20 recommendations. We have to act on them immediately. And it was really our job to investigate, yes, but to come up with some recommendations. And it was important that this be bipartisan so we can get them done.
How confident are you, Senator, that the fixes that need to be made will be made?
The ones out of this report, I feel good about that. We need a new police chief. I was listening to Lisa's excellent reporting where I, you know, much more in depth than some of the other reports that I've heard because she gets the fact that some of these changes just haven't been made. You've got understaffed department. You need a new police chief. This board has to make a decision about that police chief, and we hope that's very soon. Two new sergeant-at-arms have been installed in the House and Senate with vast experience. The other ones replaced. That is a good beginning. And then we have to get their equipment and the resources to the line officers. And one thing I'll note about the Capitol Police Board, a good first step we suggest immediately, which is to give the police chief the authority to be able to call up the National Guard without calling three people and desperately trying to reach them in the middle of an insurrection. That is one of the most absurd of many things that happened that should never have occurred.
So part of Lisa's reporting there, Senator, was that the concern is right now that if there were another attack on the Capitol of this magnitude, you might not be ready. The Capitol security system might not be ready. Is that your take as well?
I think you saw, by the way, the State of the Union, excellent security there. I think what we've seen is heightened involvement of other agencies and a different approach to this. There's been a new hire made who's handled these kinds of events before. But there's more that needs to be done. We know that. And our focus was on that security to convince our fellow senators and work with the House to get this done through the appropriations process for the funding and also make some legal changes as well. And there could be other changes to that Capitol Police Board, as Lisa has pointed out. I think the number one goal is to get the new chief in place first.
And finally, Senator, on this subject, you've been in favor of a commission created, an independent outside commission to look at what happened on January 6th. Do you still think that's necessary after this report?
Of course, I think it's more necessary. Our goal was singularly focused on the security and the failures of intelligence, but there's so much more that must be uncovered. Systematic issues, the rise of white supremacism, what got us to where we are. And that is why I strongly support that commission even more than before we entered in and presented this report.
Senator, another major issue that you are involved in, of course, is voting rights. We saw the announcement over the weekend by your fellow Democratic Senator Joe Manchin that he will oppose the big voting rights bill that's in the Senate right now, so-called S-1. Without his support, the conventional wisdom is that's dead. How do you see it?
Well, I have been talking with Senator Manchin both before his announcement, during and afterwards. Well, not during it. And it's been my impression that he has said he's going to give me a list of things, give one to Senator Schumer of things that he wants to see in a bill. He has voiced his support for the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which, of course, is very important to pass as well. But my argument is this. We've seen over 300 bills introduced all across the country to limit people's right to vote, to take away their freedom to vote, and they're not going to stop. They passed major bills in Georgia and in Florida and in other states. And so that is the argument that we are making right now. And there are many changes that I made to the For the People Act that would have moderated the bill in response to some of the issues raised by Senator Manchin and the West Virginia Secretary of State. That amendment, the manager's amendment, was a major amendment making it easier for rural areas, had the support of Mark Warner and Angus King, and unfortunately the Republicans voted it down. But it is still there along with other changes we can make. So Senator Manchin is going to have to put forth his ideas because this is a good bill, and I'm not going to give up the fight.
But without significant changes in that bill, paring it down significantly, getting Senator Manchin on board, I mean, you're looking at either the expectation is there's not going to be an end to the filibuster rule, and you're not going to get 10 Republican senators sign on to have 60 votes. So, I mean, the question is, how do you get this done?
Well, Senator Manchin has in the past indicated that he would look at a standing filibuster. And I guess if you even look at his piece that he wrote this weekend, you could say that would, in his words, I suppose, strengthen the filibuster. And so my argument is that these guys, if we're not going to abolish the filibuster, which, by the way, I favor because I want to get stuff done and I'm sick and tired of this and people manipulating the process and using archaic procedures to do that, well, then at least make them stand and argue that we shouldn't be giving water to voters in line, or that we shouldn't make it easier for people to vote in the safe way that they want to vote, whether it's voting early or voting by mail. Make them stand and do it. So he has still not precluded that, and I think that would be one way to go, along with working with him on listening to his concerns and making changes to the bill. And
that's too much power for one man to have.
I mean, this is absolutely ridiculous. Joe Manchin, I've talked about him for the last two episodes, and yeah, I'm going to mention him again here. This guy, it's ridiculous. The Democratic Party is treating this guy like he's got all this power. And he does, and he doesn't. I don't know why the democratically controlled United States Senate cannot, under the auspices of one majority leader, one Chuck Schumer, cannot just revoke committees that this guy is sitting on. Strip him of his power. Take him off committees. Get tough. I've seen some of these committees. I mean, God, I've seen Republicans get tougher on their own members than some Democrats do. I'm thinking of Liz Cheney at the minute. She got stripped of her position as a leader of a committee and a leader of a wing of the party. Although, then I think of Al Franken and how everybody disowned him. Some people have some very mixed feelings about that, by the way, but that's another episode for another day. But why is it that people in the Senate are treating Joe Manchin as if he is king? We don't have a monarchy here in the United States, but you wouldn't know it looking at the way the Senate is operating these days, as if they are being held hostage by Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin is a Dixiecrat. Joe Manchin is a money man. Joe Manchin is a hatchet man. Joe Manchin is someone who would be right at home with the Klan, because he is against the For the People Act. And you can't be for the John Lewis Act for voting and be against the For the People Act. It doesn't make sense, because they're both interlinked and intertwined pieces of legislation. And Senator Klobuchar sits there. You just heard her. Oh, we have to listen to him. Why do we have to listen to Joe Manchin for? Screw Joe Manchin. Why do we have to listen to him? Why do you, Senator, have to listen to him? You're talking about millions of people's lives here. You're talking about people voting or not voting. You're talking about people being able to have some dignity and respect. Respect. As I said earlier, how are we going to get to anything around the word great or greatness if you don't have a country that first doesn't get better? It just can't happen. And the notion that you've got Senator Klobuchar or anyone else, Chuck Schumer, as the majority leader at the minute, is not, at least publicly, bringing down the gauntlet. In fact, he's probably not doing it privately either. This is the same Joe Manchin who voted against the federal minimum wage. $15 an hour is just too much. Too much. for Joe Manchin, for these workers. We can't have that for these workers. We can't have it. And he, and you remember, Kyrsten Sinema a few months ago, on a Friday no less, made a grand showing of sticking their finger, their middle finger, up the backsides and then into the faces of everyone who would have done better having that money in their pockets. It's just horrendous. And now all of a sudden, the voters out here, we worked so hard to get this majority, slender as it is in the Senate, worked so hard, voted in the state of Georgia twice, once for president, and then just barely less than 2 months later, twice in the case of Georgia, twice more for senators to get this razor thin majority that is a majority because of Vice President Harris. And yet we're acting a fool or shacking a fool. I don't get it. I really don't understand. I mean, maybe you can tell me why it is that we get this majority, as slender though it is, and then you got Democrats acting up. Ooh, I don't think we should do this. I don't think we should abolish the filibuster. I think we're dividing the country and I wouldn't want to take part in further dividing it. I think this is a dangerous road to travel. Why are you doing that now? Why are you emerging as a Republican when we as voters worked so hard, so very hard, organizers, Black Voters Matter, Nuestro PAC, Voto Latino, all these organizations worked so hard to get Democrats in. And now that you're in, you've got one of the people in your group who is all about, well, we don't want to abolish the filibuster. And we had a nice little cozy meeting with the NAACP. Oh, wasn't it nice? They showed me and showed off to me their gold-plated cufflinks, you know. And they were so respectful about how they were doing that. Oh, it was beautiful. Oh, I had to listen. I'll listen to them again. But I won't do anything. I won't do any fucking thing. I'll just continue to say the filibuster lives on. And I'll just keep saying that the South shall rise again. Because I'm Joe Manchin. I, Dixiecrat Joe Manchin, proudly proclaim myself as a Democrat in name only. And that's really where we are. We have people who are enemies of progress, Dixiecrats, who are reemerging in the Democratic Party 2021. And George Wallace, oh, he'd be so proud of Joe Manchin.
People ask me, Val, where do you get your tireless faith that things can always get better? I got it here in Jacksonville, Florida. When you grow up in the South, poor, Black, and female, you have to have faith in progress and opportunity. My father was a janitor, and my mother was a maid. She said, Val, never grow tired of doing good. Never tired. Work hard, not just for yourself, but for others. So I went to Orlando to serve as a police officer. Met my husband and number one partner in crime fighting, Sheriff Jerry Demings. I ended up serving 27 years. I just never got tired of it. Eventually, this working mom worked her way up to chief of police.
Orlando's violent crime this year is down.
Murders, robberies, aggravated assaults, total violent crime, all lower than a year ago.
Under her leadership, there has been the most dramatic decrease in violent crime in the city's history.
They said we never lower crime, but I said never tire. And after all that, I still wasn't tired. So I ran for Congress and got back to work.
Congresswoman Val Demings,
member of the House Homeland Security, Judiciary, and Intelligence Committees.
I've never tired of representing Florida, not for one single moment.
Val Demings is someone who has taken the oath of office, not just in Congress, but to protect and serve.
And along the way, we brought law and order to a lawless president.
He is an habitual offender committing crimes in progress.
Unlike some in Washington, I never tire of standing up for what I believe is right, because no one is above the law. But it turns out there are some in Washington who prefer the same old tired ways of doing business. Too tired to fight the efforts to suppress the people's vote. They fall back to tired talking points and backward solutions.
He knows exactly what he's
doing. There it is, the memorized 25-second speech. That's what Washington, D.C. does.
My mother told me, when someone gives you the opportunity to do something big, do not disappoint them. I'm running for the United States Senate because of two simple words: never tire. Over the next few weeks, I hope to share more of my story with more of you. It's a simple question. Can my unlikely story of opportunity expand to more Americans and more Floridians?
That was remarkable. That was the campaign ad unveiled today for Representative Val Demings. She is running for the United States Senate in Florida in 2022, and she kickstarted her campaign today with that ad that you just heard. You can find it on her Twitter page, at Val Demings. That's at V-A-L-D-E-M, as in Mike, I-N, as in Nancy, G-S. Val Demings, I mean, a very impressive resume. It's a resume that would be the envy of, and is, I'm sure, the envy of so many. She has done everything that you could ask a candidate for office to do in terms of her credentials, her experience, her wisdom. And it's time that we get behind Val Demings. And even though the election is not until November of next year, as I have been talking about over the last few days, we have to prepare now. We have to get involved today, and we have to strategize for these huge Senate races, as well as your local school board races. And we have to do that today. We have to get organized today. We have to develop a plan today. We have to know, okay, how many phone calls are we going to be making? Let's look at the terrain. Let's look at the whole of the state of Florida, in this instance with Representative Val Demings, who is a member of Congress. And she, if she wins this race next year against Marco Rubio, the Republican, she will be the representative of all of the entire state and would become the first black female senator in Florida. And I think the first black senator in Florida, period, for the United States Senate. But the point of the matter is that Val Demings, oh my goodness, has a decorated career as a law enforcement officer and police chief. She served the beat on the streets of Orlando. I mean, come on. She's done it all. She was police chief. I don't know what else you can ask of her. Her career it speaks for itself. I mean, it's an outstanding resume that she's got. I don't know how else to say it. She is very much the kind of candidate that we should be looking at. Honestly, Florida needs to vote Val Demings. Vote Val. I'm telling you. She also, by the way, in case you didn't remember this, was the House impeachment manager for the Democrats in 2020. That's right, 2020. Remember, Donald Trump was impeached twice. He's the only person who ever occupied the White House to be impeached, not once, but twice. And in 2020, just over a year ago, Val Demings was one of the House impeachment managers and presented an excellent case. She was one of the two or three people on the first go-round of impeachment managers in the House who did an excellent job. So Val Demings is running. I'm so pleased about this. This is really good news. Donate to Val Demings at valdemings.com. Go to valdemings.com. valdemings.com. And you can also find her on Twitter at Val Demings. And you can also go to her Twitter page where her congressional account is, which is Rep, R-E-P, Val Demings. But you can watch that video in its entirety as I just played you the audio from it at her campaign site on Twitter, at Val Demings. So, another person that you need to be donating to. You need to start consulting. You need to ask, how can you be a part of things? How can you volunteer? No matter which state you are in the country, wherever you are, you need to get in touch with the campaign of Val Demings as she runs for the United States Senate, which is such an important seat right now. It really is. The United States Senate and any of those seats in the Senate are tremendously important for the Democratic Party. We've seen that and we know it, right? We see it right now. We've got Democrats like Val, listen to me. You've got Democrats like Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin who are really not Democrats at all. And are enemies of progress. I can assure you that Val Demings is not an enemy of progress. Marco Rubio is. And so this is imperative. We've got to get out and support her and donate to her and volunteer. Get in touch with her campaign. Do it now. Don't wait until next year. Find out what you can do today because the hard work begins now. It really does. And as I keep saying, the Republicans aren't waiting until 2022. They're not waiting until next year. They are strategizing all like now to steal these elections. They're already doing it by passing all these laws that tell you that you can't pass out bottled water on a long-ass line. And you've got to have this kind of idea, that kind of idea, this kind of idea, that. They're passing all these laws. They're not waiting until 2022 to do it. So we have got to get out there and support candidates like Val Demings. She's got a great track record. She's a leader. She's a fighter. She will definitely stand up for Florida. And we should stand up with her. Just a couple of things here before getting to the final portion of this edition of the Political Red Daily podcast. And thank you very much for listening on this Wednesday, June the 9th, hump day. And I hope you are well. And don't forget to keep checking self-examinations, lumps and bumps. I know that doesn't sound very pleasant, does it? Rather I say it and rather you hear it than you feel it. Because if you feel lumps or bumps as you do your self-examinations in the shower, in the bath, you know, that's not going to be a very pleasant experience for you. So let's be proactive about our health, please. Everyone, all of us, let's do that. Also, I want to say on a less serious note, that the Politocrat Daily Podcast store is adding products as we do here. And it's just great now that summer's around the corner, that the summer Sensations series is in full bloom, and it will be shortly, with many more products added. Some of them are going to rock you in a good way. Some of them are, well, I don't want to spoil it, but you just have to. Go to the-politocrat.myshopify.com right now to look at what is in store for you. I also want to just say that it is important to just keep yourself focused every day on the things you need to accomplish in any given day, be they large or be they small. You may not have finished what you wanted to do in a particular day, but make sure you at least start. Make sure you do that today. Well, I want to now get to the final part of this podcast episode today. And President Biden, he being the president of these United States, made his first international trip as president today with his and Dr. First Lady Dr. Jill Biden with their visit to England. They landed in England today and tonight in England at an Air Force base or an army base there in Suffolk, England, which is in it's in the southeast of England, in the East Anglia area of England and Ipswich area. President Biden and First Lady Dr. Jill Biden arrived to a very, very enthusiastic throng of United States military personnel situated at that base, which I think was called Mildenhall, Mildenhall, Mildenhall. Very enthusiastic. It was more enthusiastic, I thought, than the crowd that President Biden addressed, you know, just a few days before Memorial Day, if you remember, a couple of weeks back, just over whatever days ago it was, 10, 15, 10, 12 days ago, whatever it was. And I remember that crowd, or maybe 2 weeks ago. I remember that crowd almost 2 weeks ago now. But I remember that crowd seemed to be so different. I don't know if it was because they were more solemn. It was more so. I don't know. But this crowd tonight in England was, wow. You're going to hear some of the cheering. I mean, my gosh. But the whole point is that First Lady Dr. Jill Biden and President Joe Biden arrived in England and arrived as rock stars, let's face it, before the throngs at Mildenhall in the Army base or Air Force base there. People were absolutely taken. The military personnel were just absolutely taken with them. And you saw it, and you can definitely, you'll hear it in a few moments. But this trip that President Biden is embarking upon is a very important one. He is trying now, still in the midst of a pandemic, COVID-19, he is trying to reshape and reframe and recalibrate where America, where the United States of America stands on the world stage after what we've endured here over the last 4 years, this horror of the piece of garbage who was in the White House for 4 years, these last four. And so President Biden's job now, I think, is to try to set this tone. And I think that's what he's trying to do. And this speech that he gave tonight in England was, I think, about part of that and sending notice to Russian President Vladimir Putin. I'll play the clips. There's a couple of clips I'll play. And then that will be it for this episode. But this is a very important trip. It really is. And there are some things that you'll hear that I think are very true, that in the second clip particularly, that you'll hear that President Biden speaks of, that I think are important, because I spent the better part of the last two, if not three episodes, asking you about whether or not you feel that a democracy or that democracy period exists in the United States of America. And you know what my view is on that. And I think that President Biden is aware that even if he thinks that democracy exists in the United States, I think he's aware that it's being significantly gutted. And this country has been a fascist state for a long time, and it is becoming autocratic. It's become oligarchic. It's become plutocratic. I don't think you can deny any of that. And if you don't know what those words mean, please look them up. I'm simply saying I think that that's where we are. And I think President Biden knows that. I think he realizes that. And there's really no gentle way to say that in a speech. But this probably was one of the most gentle ways to say it. I'm going to play the second clip first. Here it is.
Our NATO allies have had our backs when it mattered, just like we've had theirs when it's mattered. And now we need to modernize our alliance, investing in our critical infrastructure, our cyber capabilities, and to keep us secure against every threat we faced over the last decade and the new challenges we're about to face as well. With the European Union leaders, I'll discuss how the United States can work with Europe to address a full range of issues that require the full strength of our transatlantic partnership, including working together to shape the new rules for the 21st century economies. And only after these meetings with our closest democratic partners to develop a common agenda and renewed purpose, I'll travel to Geneva to sit down with the man I've spent time with before, President Vladimir Putin. We're not seeking conflict with Russia. We want a stable, predictable relationship. Our two nations share incredible responsibilities, and among them, ensuring strategic stability and upholding arms control agreements. I take that responsibility seriously. But I've been clear, the United States will respond in a robust and meaningful way when the Russian government engages in harmful activities. We've already demonstrated that. I'm going to communicate that there are consequences for violating the sovereignty of democracies in the United States, in Europe, and elsewhere. I'm going to be clear that the transatlantic alliance will remain vital, a vital source of strength for the UK, Europe, and the United States. I'm going to make sure there's no doubt as to whether the United States will rise in defense of our most deeply held values and our fundamental interests. Here's why this all matters so much right now. I believe we're at an inflection point in world history, the moment where it falls to us to prove that democracies will not just endure, but they will excel as we rise to seize the enormous opportunities of a new age. We have to discredit those who believe that the age of democracy is over, as some of our fellow nations believe. We have to expose as false the narrative that decrees of dictators can match the speed and scale of the 21st challenges. You know, and I know, they're wrong. But it doesn't mean we don't have to work harder than ever to prove that democracy can still deliver for our people. For the many who think things are changing so rapidly, democracies cannot get together and form a consensus to respond like autocrats can. But you know better than anyone that democracy doesn't happen by accident. We have to defend it. We have to strengthen it, renew it. And I know that the American people are up to this job. I know because I look around this hangar. What I see is I see America. I see America, people of different backgrounds, coming together in a shared mission. Our democracy has never been perfect. Never been perfect. But Americans of all races, religions, sexual orientation, immigrants, Native Americans, all have spilled their blood to defend the values that we talk about. Generation after generation of American heroes have signed up to be part of the fight because they understand the truth that lives in every American heart, that liberation opportunity, justice is far more likely to come to pass in a democracy than in the emerging autocracies in the world. I promise you, that's what this is going to be all about for your generation and those of your children. And here's what else I know beyond a doubt. There's not a single thing, nothing beyond America's competence to accomplish when we do it together, when we do it as one people. You're proof of that. You're proof of that every single day.
President Biden there tonight in England with part of a speech to military personnel of the United States at a Air Force base in England, in Suffolk, and the base is called Mildenhall, Mildenhall. I think it was a good speech, and an important one, because it's kind of a speech that when a new leader of the so-called free world, F-R-E-E, world, comes around, that person tries to lay down a marker. And a superpower, and the United States is a superpower, whether you or I or someone perhaps likes it or does not like it, that person who is coming out of a fresh off an election where they had a mandate and at least 7 million votes majority, where a record number of people in the history of the country voted for them, they have a right to set the terminology and everything else. We do want a better world. I don't see anyone, and I don't hear anyone going, I want a great world. We all say, or all the times I've heard people say at least, I want a better world. I've never heard anyone in the history of the world say, I want a great world. I want a great world. I've never heard that. Have you? All I've ever heard people say, all my life, was and is, I want a better world. So, again, this goes back to what I said earlier about these slogans and all this pathetic stuff about, oh, make it great again. When it still isn't better, and great for whom? If we're not saying that we want a great world, and if we are saying that we want a better world, then by definition, don't we want a better country? We can't have a great country without first having a better country. And we are not, at the minute, a better country. We are still trying to ignore the original sins of this country. So that does not make us better. There's not been any reparations paid out to black people as a whole, so that doesn't make us better. Even though, yes, there's Evanston, Illinois, and there's Bruce's Beach in Southern California, and we're hopefully going to have news, well, I don't know, I'm not going to get ahead of anything because I don't know, about Greenwood at some point, hopefully. But we've been asking about this for Greenwood forever, and the people of Greenwood have been asking about this. Where's our damn money? Where's our freaking money? Where's our reparations? You know, where's our victim compensation fund? That is reparations. But my whole point here, dear listener, is to just say once again that this is the methodology. No one's talking about a great world. People are talking about a better world. And therefore, you're also talking about a better country. That's what you want. You want a better country. Screw these superlatives, great. What the hell does that mean? And you've got all this unemployment. You've got people who are homeless all over the place. You've got people who can't bloomin' well vote. You've got people who try to seek asylum here and are getting thrown back into the alligator pit. You got no health care. You got no infrastructure. Your education sucks. So how can the bloomin' country be great? How can you be advocating for it to be great if it ain't better? If it's got all those things that I just talked about. Police killing black people like it's out of fashion, which it never has been. women can't freaking well get equal pay in a lot of jobs still. Asians getting beaten up and killed all over the country. What kind of a great country? Yeah, I don't understand these people. Oh, great. Great. Well, yeah, because maybe you're the person who says this or the people who say this are the stone-cold racists that we always knew that they were and that they always knew that they were. But we can't be calling for someone to be great if we are saying things like, this is not who we are. If we're saying these things where we're not even looking at ourselves, where we're not even willing to be honest enough to look at ourselves as we are, as James Baldwin said, not as some kind of fantasy or figment of an imagination that really is dead and doesn't exist. And as I keep saying, you know, we're going to turn. This country will turn 245 years old in about 3 weeks' time. And we are going to, many of us, not you, not me, maybe. Well, not definitely not me, not you, maybe. Waving flags. And half of us, or a great many more than half, are not going to know why we're waving them, apart from the obvious answer, independence. And other people will say, freedom! And that's being curtailed. So, come on now. We've got to, at some point, be adults, grow up a little bit, and actually look at the actual history of the country. Because you cannot move forward unless you address that until you face it head on. As James Baldwin once said, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. Thank you very much for listening to this edition of The Politocrat. I'm Omar Moore.
Ladies and gentlemen, let us welcome our Commander-in-Chief, the President of the United States, Joe Biden.
Thank you for that introduction and your service leading this team in such a difficult time. Because we know that there's a whole family who serves. I also want to thank Melissa. I know your next assignment is U.S. Transportation Command starts soon. So congratulations and thank you, thank you, thank you. And Sydney, you're 14 years old. When I was 14, if you please, at ease. I keep forgetting I'm president. When I was 14 years old, I would have been, I mean it sincerely, scared to death to stand up in front of a microphone to a large crowd or a small crowd. See, when I was a child, I used to stutter badly, for real. I had great difficulty speaking in front of other people. So I expect that when you're president, you'll remember me. You'll remember me. You're really quite a polished young woman.